The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I'm honored to introduce our guests this evening. Eddie Esclod Jr. is the Chair of the Department of African American Studies and the James S. McDonnell Distinguished University Professor at Princeton University. He is the author of numerous acclaimed books, including Democracy in Black, How Race Still Enslaves the American Soul, which the Los Angeles Times called one of the most imaginative, daring books of the 21st century. In it, Dr. Glaud vehemently argues against the idea that America exists as a post-racial society. He is also the author of Exodus, Religion, Race, and Nation in the Early 19th Century Black America, and he is a frequent commentator on MSNBC. In his latest book, Begin Again, Glaud offers guidance in our current struggles with race and trauma by braiding his own concerns and critiques with James Baldwin's political, literary, and personal evolution. Our friend Cornell West writes, "This book is undoubtedly the best treatment we have of Baldwin's genius and relevance. With subtle brilliance and heartfelt tears, Glaud breaks bread with Baldwin in order to give us courage and hope." Tonight, Professor Glaud will be in conversation with Tamala Edwards, anchor of 6ABC Action News Morning Edition and a longtime friend of Author Events and the Free Library of Philadelphia. Tam and Dr. Glaud, the screen is all yours.
Wonderful. And Dr. Glaud, do you want me to call you Dr. Glaud?
No,
you can call me
Eddie.
Tam.
Eddie, okay, would good. Be much better. Thank you.
We have enough separation with coronavirus. We're old friends at this point. Thank you so much for writing the book. I think James Baldwin occupies a unique space in our souls and in our minds. And like you, I think many of us don't quite know what to do with him all the time. He's like an octagon. You can't see all the sides at any one time. Right. And it's fascinating to watch someone attempt it. And I thought for people who have the book and maybe in different places with it, a good starting point might be to explain, with everything that you've been interested in and everything you've written about, where you began in the book, explaining that you were aware of him going back to being a graduate student, but there was something about him. He was almost too fierce, and he took you to places you weren't so sure about, that it took you time to come back around to him, to sort of explain your journey into wanting to write about him.
Yeah, I knew Baldwin was going to be a challenge. You know, in graduate school at Princeton, whenever we read him, I found myself, Sister Tam, trying to negotiate and navigate the uncomfort, the fact that he made my colleagues uncomfortable. There would be red faces, flushed cheeks as we read him, because Baldwin gave the truth straight, no chaser, you know? Mm-hmm. And then there was this kind of demand in reading him, right? When you read him, there was this insistence that you examined your own lies, right? That he believed in the Socratic dictum that the unexamined life isn't worth living. And so to the extent to which that's true, that meant that I had to deal with the fact that I am still this vulnerable little boy who's afraid of his daddy, you know? And I wasn't ready to deal with that. So, you know, when I got into graduate school, you know, I wrote about Ralph Ellison. You know, I liked Ellison's cool pose. I liked the sophistication of his prose. You know, he was invoking Kenneth Burke. He was talking about the buildings roman, right? There was a clear philosophical apparatus informing his aesthetic. So I could, his mask fit perfectly as I write in the book. Baldwin was both, you know, fire and wind, you know, fire, you know, and, you know, it's just anger and love all boiled into one. And I knew I wasn't mature enough to manage him. So I had to wait. And then I started teaching Fire Next Time. And when I started teaching the Fire Next Time, when I got to Bowdoin, up in Maine, of all places, that's when it just opened up. And then I returned to him, started near the end of graduate school, but right at my first year of teaching at Bowdoin, everything just kind of blew up.
Was there a sense of a kindred spirit, though, with Baldwin? You have a more loving relationship with your father, but you talk about the fear. You all can say, I love you now. He never got that with his father, David. But he knew what it was to live up close to somebody that you tiptoed around. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you, and he wrote frankly about it. And I wondered if there was a recognition in that, that both pulled you close and pushed you away.
Yeah, when you read him over the course of his career, you see he becomes much more generous in his reading of his father. Right. So typically in the beginning, when you read Notes of a Native Son or the early essays, there is this kind of judgment that his father capitulated to, you know, what the world said about him. And by the time you get to the end of his life, by 87, he's talking about his father less as succumbing to the world, as being a victim of the world, you know, and it's a much more loving and generous read. So there's that kind of understanding of the evolution of Baldwin's understanding of his relationship with his dad. And then there's my own struggle. I look exactly like my father. Hmm. I mean, same hands. Even people who went to junior high school with him, when I go home to my hometown, if I'm walking around, they would immediately say, you're Eddie Glaude's son. Same walk. And when we both get angry, same face. And so it is clear to me that the connection, the visceral connection to Baldwin, has everything to do with trying to navigate this overwhelming presence in one's life. Because, you know, I've said before, my dad deposited fear in me at an early age. And I've been trying to prove that I'm courageous ever since. You know, now it's hilarious. He calls to tell me what I should say on television. It's funny.
Well, at least there's that. You know, in the book, you talk a lot about Baldwin grappling with many forces, and who he is when he's first dealing with the civil rights movement, going to see the young people, sitting in that room at Howard University, looking into their faces, overcome by the fire and the youthful exuberance. And then who he is years later, looking at the Reagan Revolution, and he's almost spent. He's worn out, sitting in a jazz bar with his brother, trying to make sense of it all. And, you know, there's something, you talk always about his relationship with love, that even when you think he's pushed it away and he's let go of it, it's there, it's just morphing. But you mention a couple of things that he says that show you the trajectory. He goes from saying, we cannot be free until they are free, meaning white people, to sort of a shrug of the shoulders, we'll share it or we'll perish, I don't care. That's an interesting relationship with love. It's like the person you can't quit, but you're crawling out the door.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I think love for Baldwin, you know, functions on a number of different levels. He invokes it in every sense of the Greek words, right? So it's agape, it's philia, it's eros. And it's also deployed in a way to ensure that we don't become monstrous, right? So love orients us to the world in such a way that we don't duplicate the very thing that we're condemning. It holds off an all-consuming rage. It keeps rage from morphing into hatred, because there's nothing good there for you. Because if hatred takes root, then you too will become monstrous, right? And so there's a sense in which Baldwin is grappling, you know, by the time they murder Dr. King, and he's like, you know, they killed the apostle of love. What does it say about them? You know, he's not naive about a harmful touch. He's not naive about the violence of human beings. But he says that this says something about who these folks are. And it shifts, because what you're noting here is the shift in his we, right? That he's not so much concerned about saving white folks as he is about trying to build a world where these noxious views have no quarter to breathe. And that sometimes expresses itself in a kind of an intense anger, right? And this is what I say to people who read Begin Again. You can't run past Jimmy's rage. The rage lights the kiln. And so you gotta deal with that anger. You can't move it away. And that anger is really important to understanding the shift between those two passages you just read.
You know, you also talk about how in his lifetime and very early on, you could go from being the celebrity, the star, to being the whipping boy. You know, to see your work torn apart by other Black writers, or the way the Black Panthers had a take on him. And yet he continued to have an interesting vantage point on what he thought Black people ought to be doing. And he said it in the book, "I would like to do something unprecedented, to create ourselves without finding it necessary to create an enemy." And you call it, he wanted us to stay away from the mystical Black bullshit. I wanted to know exactly what he meant. And he said, you know, white people make identity politics necessary. Don't get trapped. So yeah. Where was he pushing us? Like, an unprecedented thing. And what is mystical Black bullshit? So when you see it, step away from it.
So that's the easy part, right? The mystical Black bullshit is this idea that our Blackness confers upon us some necessary ethics, some politics, some inherent connection to each other. That by virtue of being born Black in the world, you automatically have a relationship with other Black people. You automatically hold a certain kind of politics. You automatically have a certain kind of rhythm, a certain kind of style. Baldwin's like, come on, that's as if some metaphysical Blackness swoops down and then, and infests the baby, and then boom, you get Black people. He's worried about this. And in some ways he's challenging at that moment a certain kind of cultural nationalist position that presumes that Black people qua Black people are by definition, right, a certain kind of people, right? That our culture orients us to each other and to the world in particular sorts of ways. And that if you're not in line with that understanding of Black culture, you're either an Uncle Tom, or you've sold out, or you are miseducated, or the like. And Baldwin wants to suggest here that that kind of understanding of Blackness flattens the complexity, the rich diversity of who we are. Because Jimmy wants to insist on this notion of individuality, but he doesn't want to invoke it and embrace that notion of individuality in such a way that he denies the cultural power of Black communities. He just doesn't want us to get trapped, because that's just the category. You know, we're just releasing the category, and then we're boxing ourselves in, right? It's what he sees in the Nation of Islam, for example, in The Fire Next Time. They're just flipping the script, right? They're just turning it upside down, but they're not getting outside of the frame. So Baldwin is insistent that we understand ourselves in the broadest sense of in the broadest sense possible, in the most expansive sense possible. That passage you read comes from an essay that he wrote. It's his letter of resignation from The Liberator, which was a Black nationalist periodical that had been accused of anti-Semitism. And Ossie Davis had resigned from its board, and Jimmy resigned from the board. And what he was saying is that we can't become as monstrous as the folk we're fighting against. And then that's when he drops that line that almost brings me to tears every single time. I want us to do something unprecedented. And that is create a self without the need for enemies, right? And that means stepping outside of the frame of these categories that box us in. But it's not, I want to be very clear, it's not an embrace of some sentimentalist understanding of the universal human being. I don't see color. That's bullshit too, right? For Jimmy, right? That's not what he's suggesting by not falling in the trap. And he's also not suggesting that to create oneself without the need for enemies also involves leaving behind the particular beauty of Black culture, right? He's not turning his back on that either. It's just, how do we understand it? How do we render it in all of its complexity and fullness, you see?
Well, and that's what he's insisting on. Time. that, you know, we continue to do this to one another, that there is a way to be Black. There is a, it's not an ecumenical thing. You know, there's an orthodoxy to it. It was there then, it's there now. And so I wonder what he would think in this moment, because we continue to have these fights among ourselves.
Right. So, you know, I think we have to understand those fights for what they are, right? So, I mean, identity politics can release the trap, but we have to understand why identity politics is are alluring in the first place, right? I mean, if you're catching hell, you know, Walter Wallace isn't dead just because he was having a mental episode.
Very true.
Right. There's a particular body wielding that knife. And there's a sense in which the Black, you know, there's a way in which understanding our relationship with each other can easily fall into a kind of, or simply fall into a kind of easy rendering of what should bind us to each other. I can just invoke Blackness as a condition for us being in solidarity with each other, as opposed to doing the hard work of politics to build solidarity among Black folk, right? In some ways it makes us, as I say in Democracy in Black, a certain crude understanding of Black identity politics actually makes us pre-political, that we don't have to do politics. We just assume that Black people, qua Black people, are always together, and those who are not are somehow malformed, right? And I just want to reject that view altogether, you know? But I do understand it, the reason for the impulse, though.
What do you think he would make of Black Lives Matters, in particular, their stated goal that they hold to of not having a set leader, of keeping it a disparate, everybody's together, but everybody's their own leader, that is very different than what he saw, which is this creation of a movement that was very much so about its leaders?
You know, actually, he would probably quibble. Let me just say this. I'm very leery of trying to anticipate Jimmy's words. You know, this 7,000 pages, and within those 7,000 pages, we probably could find something that he said that would speak to the moment. But, you know, the first thing I would say is that, you know, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, its leadership model is exactly the same as what you've described with BLM. Miss Ella Baker used to tell those SNCC organizers, shut up, maybe you might learn something, as they were talking and organizing with those sharecroppers in Mississippi, for example. Bob Moses told me the story of how Fannie Lou Hamer emerged. They were driving in the bus, some folk to go register, and Black folk were nervous as hell, and this woman in the back of the bus sang every spiritual known to man, he said. And they were trying to figure out what she was doing. And then they realized what she was doing. She was calming the spirit before they entered the storm. And he said, that woman turned out to be Fannie Lou Hamer. And so the idea that Miss Hella Baker said is that we're the leaders we've been looking for. Very skeptical of a kind of charismatic, preacherly drug-driven kind of model that was SCLC and NAACP, right? And so it's this broad democratic approach. Right? How do we cultivate the capacities of folk in our group and everyday ordinary folk to lead for themselves? So Black Lives Matter actually reflects in some ways, it's in that tradition of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And you know what? There are only two organizations that Jimmy supposedly joined, and one was SNCC and the other was CORE. So he identified with those young folk, and the way in which I remember how I began the book in chapter one, he's at Howard. He's in the apartment of Michael Thelwell, another, I don't know if it was Michael Thelwell's apartment, but these are Howard students who are SNCC activists. Michael Thelwell, Stokely Carmichael, Muriel Tillinghast, right? These are SNCC activists that he's speaking to. And so what would he say? I don't wanna put words in his mouth, but I think what would be consistent with what I know of him as a longtime reader of him, is that it's a shame that another generation has to go through this shit. Excuse my language.
I think that's what he would say.
Yeah, and B, our babies are always reflecting our courage, right? Our babies are always putting themselves on the line for us. We need to stand with them.
I think you're right. And, you know, I was a line that you have in the book you know, where you talk about various things and you say the compromise of so many, including my friends, who hope to finally walk the corridors of power. You know, it made me think of, we thought we were getting to a certain place and then we weren't. And if you don't mind, I wanted to read one thing from the book. Sure. Where you talk about something he said, and it sort of brought it home to me, that we were reminded in this time that no matter what you have, the degrees, the wealth, all of us, none of us are saved, because it comes back to our babies. And he says this, I'm talking about what happens to you if, having barely escaped suicide or death or madness or yourself, you watch your children growing up, and no matter what you do, no matter what you do, you are powerless. You are really powerless against the force of the world that is out to tell your child that he has no right to be alive. And no amount of liberal jargon and no amount of talk about how well and how far we have progressed does anything to soften or to point out any solution to this dilemma. In every generation, ever since Negroes have been here, every Negro mother and father has had to face that child and try to create in that child some way of surviving this particular world, some way to make the child who will be despised not despise himself. I don't know what the Negro problem means to white people, but this is what it means to the Negroes.
Yeah.
It took me back to my youthful exuberance that my generation was going to go places my father's generation did not, that we would reach the mountaintop. And to be back in this moment where he was and my grandparents were, where on a primal level you fear for your child. And it was almost as if Baldwin was presaging this, that this is what holds us all in the struggle.
Yeah, you know, that's from The Uses of the Blues. And I remember when I first read that, you know, it shook me to my core. You know, I have my son, he's now, you know, we've done everything right. You know, his godfather's Cornell West, he went to Brown, he's, you know, he's doing everything. The boy went to Brown. He didn't go to Morehouse. I didn't hold it against him, but it was what it was, right? It is what it is. But I remember he came home one summer and he was working for a lobbying firm, Tam, he was so excited because they were about to lobby lawmakers in Trenton around criminal justice reform. And, you know, he bought that H&M suit, you know, how these young folk wear that tight suit. And,
yes.
You know,
with the skinny legs.
Yes. And he was all tight and he got in his little Honda Civic and he was going and he came home. And my son was a basketball player, 6'2". And he came home and I immediately saw something was wrong with him. And I said, what's going on? He said, Dad, when I got to the Capitol, I was trying to park. A police officer stopped me and just started screaming on me for no reason. And I was asking him what was going on. And he told me, you're just gonna drive by me. And then he told me to go park somewhere else. And then he says, and Dad, as I went to go park somewhere else, another cop stopped me. And as he's saying this, I could see the rage and his eyes are welling up in tears and tears just running down his face. And he says, another cop stopped me, Dad. And he starts screaming on me. And I'm like, I'm just trying to find a place to park. I'm working here, we're doing something, da da da. And then he yells at me to go park again. And Dad, I got stopped again. And at this point, tears are running down my baby's eyes. He's towering over me. And he says, Dad, you know what this MF said to me? He asked me who was my PO. He asked me who was my PO. For those of you who don't know what that is, who was my parole officer? He asked me, Dad. And I'm watching my baby, my only child, right? Tears running down his eyes, angry. And I'm trying to figure out how to keep this from taking root in his soul. How to keep this anger from turning in on him. So, you know, I went and got my McCallum 25 and poured a scotch for my baby and said, let's talk this through. So what Baldwin was saying in that moment spoke to me. This same child working for a law firm in New York comes home after COVID, comes and tells me, I got to go protest. I got to go to Trenton after what happened to George Floyd. I can't stay here. I even pulled the mama card. You can't go out and expose yourself to COVID and da da da. Right? So part of what Jimmy is saying in that moment He said, we got to raise our babies in this. We got to raise them in such a way that they don't believe what the world says about them. And we have to raise them so that they can stand upright when the world tries to buckle them at the knees, right? So one of the reasons why I linger on that passage you read is because I lived it in real time, you know? I lived it in real time. And he's right, still, you know?
Which breaks your heart, that he continues to be right at every turn.
Yeah, it says it's an indictment of the country.
I wanted to talk a little bit more about his loneliness on two levels. On one hand, he seemed to crave it. I'm going to move to Turkey on and off for a decade, but never learn the language, so I can move around and be lost in my own head and not dragged into everybody else's conversation. And I thought that that was pretty amazing that he calls it the elsewhere. You write about it in an amazing chapter called Elsewhere and the need for having that. And I wanted you to speak a little bit on the about the importance of that elsewhere.
You know, Tam, it's funny that you talk about that chapter. It almost wasn't written. Because my initial
It's my favorite point, in the book.
Oh my goodness, that's great to hear. I was supposed to go to Istanbul and I was going to retrace Baldwin's steps. I was going to go to his old haunts and really just kind of describe, you know, Istanbul now and compare it and do all that. And I remember someone saying to me, man, you're a critic of Donald Trump. You're going to go to Erdogan's Istanbul? You might not make it back, bro. And my editor was like, I don't think we should do this. So my editor was like, well, why don't you just go interview some activists? And I was like, we're always extracting from these young folk. Let me try to write something for them. And so Elsewhere was this attempt to kind of offer us some insight in what we need to replenish, that we may not have the money to go overseas, and we may not have the will to experience the poverty that Jimmy experienced in Paris, or we don't have the resources to, you know, rent a flat in London, in Tedworth Square, or be in Istanbul. But what Baldwin was trying to do was not to live in exile. He was just trying to find the distance so that he could understand the behemoth, so that he could make sense of this place. So we have to find our elsewheres. And what I say is that we have to find those communities of love that allow us to laugh full belly laughs, that will allow us to rage, right, to cuss at the top of our lungs. And those people who will sturdy our spines when our knees buckle, and allow us to be vulnerable so that we can replenish and re-enter the fray. We need to acquire the requisite distance so that we can see the operations of power and the temptation that we may face to take the bribe. Right? So we have to pull away, not become so taken with the awards and the accolades, right? To find the requisite distance so that we don't lose our voice, so that we can still speak the truth when our time comes to speak it, so that we can still bear witness. So I didn't want to say Baldwin was never in exile. He just found his elsewhere to speak the truth, to bear witness. And that's what we need to do.
But throughout the book, there's a deep loneliness in him that no matter who's around, you know, there's no intimate partner that works out over the long haul. Friends are there, but they come and go. But there's, you write about one time he comes off the stage and somebody notes he's shaking. Like he's just, that's who he is, worked up on every level. And somebody in the book says, you know, the man became a personality. The personality became the story. The story became the myth.
Yeah.
And that's how the world saw him and sees him. But even the cover of the book, as I'm looking at it right now, he's looking off into the distance. There's just a heavy loneliness about him that just feels painful.
Yeah. You know, in The Price of the Ticket, he says he never thought that anyone could love an ugly little boy like him. Right. And, you know, it was David Baldwin who told him that he was too ugly, in effect, to be loved. So there is wound there. He's wounded. Baldwin was clear about his own desires, you know, and he's extraordinarily courageous. You can just imagine writing Giovanni's Room in the 1950s. And it's the second novel after Go Tell It on the Mountain, right? It's completely different. The US would refuse to publish it. And, you know, when I interviewed Angela Davis for the book, you know, and she still lights up like a little girl when she talks about Baldwin. It's amazing to watch. She said in so many ways, he was out there by himself, alone, right? And Baldwin says, I wrote Giovanni's Room, right? You couldn't hold that over me, my sexuality over me, I told you, right? It's a beautiful formulation, right? So he's always misfitted, always standing slightly at an angle. Misfitted in the context of the 40s and 50s, misfitted in the context of the civil rights movement and the Black Power movement, misfitted in the context of the 80s when, you know, Black middle class and upper middle class taking off, those folks who undergird, you know, the Cosby moment, the Cosby show years and the like. He's standing in a different kind. He's always at a distance, at an angle. And it's because as an artist, he takes his task to bear witness, right? To bring his amazing perception to bear on the experiences had. That's why I chose that photo. It comes from another place, right? A short film, beautiful film, about his time in Istanbul. He's actually at a tea house in Bebek, and he's being very coquettish. I mean, he's flirting with these young boys and he has his little tea, but then his eyes go off into a distance. He's elsewhere, he's someplace else. And we have to understand it, that he's still in a very vulnerable position. He's in a vulnerable place because he had just tried to commit suicide in 1969. And No Name in the Street, which is the spine of Begin Again, No Name in the Street is this, as he called it, this mighty motherfucker, as he puts it, right? It's beating him down. And he hasn't finished the book yet at this moment. So he's wondering if he will ever finish it. But you're right though, that loneliness, I feel it too, but you know, it is what it is.
In the book, you write about the moment that we're in politically, and obviously this is before the election. We don't know how it's going to go when you're writing. We know now that it was not the landslide that was predicted one way or the other. And you know, you talk about white supremacy, you call it the lie, that Baldwin saw it as the lie. 72 million people is a lot of people who, you know, because I think in the book it's set up as we're going to go one way or the other. Are we going to go this way or fall into incrementalism or pick something else? So what do you make of this moment when that's a whole lot of folk?
Yeah, 73 million clearly plus picked now. That. It's yeah. 73 million plus now. I think we're still at the crossroads. The election didn't resolve anything. I'm from the Gulf Coast. I'm from a small town called Moss Point, Mississippi. Country boy to the core. And, you know, growing up on the coast, Tam, I know a little bit about hurricanes. And, you know, the front end of a hurricane is very violent. Very violent. It'll tear up the town. The eye of the storm is calm. You can walk out and assess the damage. You can try to reattach some boards. But it's an illusion because the tail's coming. And the tail is just as violent as the front end. We're in the eye of the storm. That's where we are. And so people, the goal wasn't the election of Biden and Harris. The goal is a more just America. They're just the moment to help us get there. And so 73 million are a lot of folk, and many of whom aren't committed to democratic norms. Many will not extend legitimacy to the Biden-Harris administration. Many will deepen their disaffection and alienation from the democratic process. We have to buckle up. And if we trade one fantasy for another, if we trade one fantasy for another, we will seal our fate.
What do you make of the fact that a third of Latinos, a third of Asians, and an increased number of Black men? Like, you can't say that this is all about one group and you can define them. There's something that's alluring. Can you hear it? Can you understand it? Does it make sense to you? Would it have made sense to Baldwin?
No, you know, I think, you know, the thing is that America is, you know, we suffer not only from white supremacist ideology, but we suffer from an extraordinary degree of selfishness. I mean, the country that, I mean, wearing a mask is considered liberty. Not wearing a mask is considered you know, an exercise of one's liberty. Government trying to enforce a mask mandate is somehow tyrannical, right? So there's a kind of selfishness that threatens the body politic. And white people don't have a monopoly on selfishness. White folk don't have it's not their possession to be concerned only with their 401ks and their retirement, you know, their stock market portfolios and the like. So selfishness, right, is part of the mixture. Donald Trump sits at the sweet spot of greed, selfishness, and racism. That mixture is his fuel, has been his fuel. And so when you see this kind of increase in the number of folk voting, you're going to see an increase in the support among, so, you know, among various communities for folk who they think will benefit their self-interest. So just statistically, it makes sense that we're going to see an uptick in those numbers because we saw an uptick in the number of people who voted. It just makes sense in that regard. But selfishness is not the possession of white folks, right? We got some selfish black folk too.
Clearly. I want to round to something you said about the eye of the storm. You know, a lot of people is, you know, part of being in the eye of the storm is exhaustion. You've made it through one end, but there's more to come. And there was a quote in the book that spoke to me on a soul level, this idea of an elsewhere, like how do you find your own elsewhere? And it says this, and it was from Baldwin, "In America, I was free only in battle, never free to rest. And he who finds no way to rest cannot long service the battle." And it just said to me, it spoke to the exhaustion. Mm-hmm. It spoke to the exhaustion. How do you in this moment find your elsewhere? You know, I find that I'm having a hard time focusing. I'm having a hard time not pushing away. And you know that you do need to come back around again. You've got to stay here. Yeah. Where do we find our elsewhere?
Well, you got to find it with people who you love, first of all. And be open to expanding that community of love, right? Love is the elixir, right? It is the source that keeps, you know, the spirit greased, right? So it doesn't lock up, you know. I'm not being sentimental, because sentimentality for me is a mask for cruelty. I'm not interested in sentimentality. I'm talking about what does it mean to be affirmed in one's very being, right? That these people aren't interested in you being on television. They don't care about your personality. They know, as you know, as they would say, they know I knew you in, and mm-hmm. you're not going to get new with me, right? They'll tell you the truth, right, about yourself. And I think those communities, if you nurture them, they allow you to retreat and then go back in. But we're in a moment where retreat is very difficult to do, because it's coming. And what I've learned from Baldwin is that even in those moments when he seemed most fragile, when he seemed to collapse, he found it within himself to pick up the pieces again. Because I wrote Begin Again, Tam, because I was in despair. I was disillusioned, you know? And I knew Jimmy had been through another moment when the country had betrayed us. Because I'm sitting here thinking, I'm watching them electing Donald Trump, and I go, they've done it again. These folks then turned around and did it again. And I said on Nicole Wallace the other day, I said, you know, black folk, it's as if we're damned if you do, damned if you don't. If we don't show up at the rate that we should, the country ends up electing someone like Donald Trump. When we do show up like we should, they try to steal our votes. They try to take it away from us, right? And it gives us this kind of insight into the very vexed nature of our relationship with this polity. So Baldwin helped me understand that you got to pick up the pieces and you got to push this damn boulder back up the hill. And in the meantime, you know, have some folk who love you along the way.
And that is great life advice in every way. I wanted to go to some of the questions that we're getting.
Sure.
One person said, do you recommend reading his books in order? Or, you know, there's some people who think they're the major works from him and then the minor works, some you can dismiss. And then there are people who like to read in order. What do you think?
So I teach a seminar on Baldwin's nonfiction. And, you know, I love the Library of America edition of his collected nonfiction works, or you could read The Price of the Ticket. But I think it's important to start with Notes of a Native Son and then move through the work chronologically so that you can actually see the continuity of theme and notice the shifts. But the problem with that, the Library of America edition, is that it doesn't include the last book, The Evidence of Things Not Seen, which is a book about the Atlanta child murders. And see, Baldwin, that book is many people think it's a mess. Michael Thelwell said it needed a good editing and it didn't make any sense. I think it's just sheer genius. And one of the reasons why I think people didn't want to take it up, I mean, it needs a good edit, but I think folk don't turn to it very much or very often. It's because Baldwin is trying to answer the question, how did all these Black babies get killed with all these Black folk in power in Atlanta? Hmm. What do we do when the face of white supremacy still obtains, but Black folks hold the reins of power?
Steve.
You see? So that's almost like that juxtaposition of Obama calling folk thugs in Baltimore as the CVS is burning down, right? And folk didn't know how to make sense of this. Baldwin's writing about, he's anticipating this in 1987. This is the last book published. So I would suggest, you know, start at the beginning. You know, I jump over books. You know, I've had a hard time with Devil Finds Work, although there's some brilliant points in that book about, you know, entertainment and movies and the like, but it's not just simply about movies and Baldwin's film criticism. But start with the beginning and just move your way through, you know.
Is there one in particular that you love the most that you will always come back to?
Well, you know, there's a twin. I couldn't answer one. Sorry, Tam. If the fire next time is The Prophecy, No Name in the Street is The Reckoning. So I like to read those two books in tandem. But I teach Fire Next Time every year.
Your book made me want to go back because I feel as though I've read excerpts of everything, but to really make the time and the space to sit with them in a whole different way. Looking at the next question, this is an interesting one. Please discuss your evaluation of the African-American leadership of Newark. That's from Morris.
You know, I can't say anything substantive about it in the sense that, you know, let's be clear, just because one is a pundit doesn't mean you need to talk about everything. So I know Brother Roz Baraka at a surface level. Mm-hmm. I know what they're trying to do in that city. My prayers are with that city because of what COVID is doing right now. But I can't really say anything substantively about what they're up to because I don't know. And so I don't want to pass judgment about something I don't know anything about.
It's so funny. One of these questions was one of the ones on my list that I stopped because I wanted to give other people a chance. And it was about, how do you find hope in the everyday? And this is the last two things that I wrote on my list of things, Eddie. It was these two quotes. Hope is invented every day by Baldwin. And a hope not hopeless, but unhopeful by Du Bois. And I was I'm going to hold on to those two.
Yeah, that Du Bois phrase is one of my favorite. That Du Bois formulation is one of my favorites. It's a blues-soaked hope. This is not Voltaire's Candide. This is not Panglossian optimism that we're in the best of all possible worlds. No. This is my mother, you know, nobody loves me but my mother. She could be jiving too. That's B.B. King kind of love, you know. So a hope not hopeless, but unhopeful. Or the idea that hope is invented every day. But you have to think about it, right? The formulation is tied to how do you get up in the morning when you know you might not have enough money to pay the rent when you know your cupboards are bare and the icebox don't have food in it, when you know you don't have the money to get your kids the books that they need, how do you get up in the morning when the world seems like it's arrayed against you, right? How do you swing your feet around and get them off the bed and put them on the floor? And Baldwin is trying to say is that for Black folk, this journey, right, from this journey to now has involved having to invent hope every day in the midst of those sorts of circumstances, of how to figure out how to make do in the midst of that. How do you swing your feet around and plant them on the floor and stand the hell up, right? So hope is invented every day. It's invented in that morning when you, and Baldwin is saying, he says this in Nothing Personal, this wonderful essay he wrote with Richard Avington for the book on photography. He says at 4 o'clock in the morning, when you think life isn't worth living anymore, when you want to just end it all, how do you swing your feet off the bed and plant them on the floor? And what does he do? He reaches for the love of his family, that his life isn't his own, the love of folk who are in around him, right? So how do I find hope, to answer the question? Hope is invented every day. Hope is found in my faith that human beings are at once disasters, but we are also miracles. That if we show up, we have a chance for a miracle. Because if I don't have any hope, if I don't have a faith in us, I would drink too much Jameson, right? I wouldn't be able to swing my feet around, right? It's that moment, give you a quick story. I know we're running out of time, but this quick story. Dr. King was engaged in an action in Mississippi, in the Delta, about 67. And these elementary school kids, they were trying to integrate this school. And the white superintendent, the white principal, they let the Black kids out early. And King watched these white men and women attack these babies, breaking their legs with tree limbs and pipes. And after seeing it, he retreated to his bed. He refused to get up. And Andy Young talks about this, and he says that we've all experienced a kind of depression, but I had never seen him like this. He refused to move. And it just so happened that a folk singer, Joan Baez, was coming the next day to participate in the action. And they said, he won't get up. He won't acknowledge our presence. He won't swing, in my language, he won't swing his feet and plant them on the floor and stand up. And so she got up, she sat next to his bed and she started singing a cappella, Pilgrim Sorrow. And when she got to the second verse, his eye opened and she kept singing and he swung around and he got up. Hope is invented every day.
Leads us to our next question. Somebody said, you know, we saw something incredible over the last few weeks. People, even in the middle of a pandemic with everything going on, they showed up and showed out. They did what they had to do. But they say the fear, of course, is complacency. That if everybody says, well, we're done now, I did what I needed to do. How do you keep people from complacency, which is very much a part of the sclerotic body politic?
Well, the first thing is to insist what I just said earlier, and that is that the goal was not the election of Biden and Harris. The goal is a more just America. I'm already a bit skeptical that this is, you know, they're reaching for a lot of the expertise of the Obama and Clinton years. And I'm worried what is the policy vision. I hope they implement the Democratic platform, which is the most progressive platform that we've ever seen from one of the major political parties up to this point, but we will have to see. I think for African-American voters in particular, we've fallen for the okey-doke once. We got all excited about 2008, and we thought with the election of Barack Obama that there was going to be fundamental change. And what we saw instead was, you know, this extraordinary expression of hatred, that the ugly underbelly of America made itself clearly known. And then people were trying to tinker around the edges. So exhaustion can lead people to say, well, we did it. But I think activists are very, very clear that they have to continue to push. And day one, January 21st, we need to continue to push for policy that actually respond at scale to the level of problems that we're facing as a nation.
In the book, you talk about there are times to push and times, as you call it, that you need to buy time, that you thought 2016 was a time to push. You know, Hillary ain't it. Be mindful, but in some places you could say she ain't it. And you're like, I didn't realize we needed to buy time. You know, you're talking about January 21st. How are you going to evaluate whether or not it's time to push or we still need to buy time?
We've bought the time already. We elected them, right? We elected them. And see, the thing is this, it is insane to me for folk to believe that what we need is to go back to what was prior to Donald Trump. I remember during the protest, they were interviewing this young Black woman in New York, and she was like, go back to what? I was protesting Trayvon Martin's murder. What you want me to go back to, right? What do you want us to go back to? A society that has the top 1% continuously extracting while everyday ordinary working people barely keeping their nose above water? You want us to go back to police killing us, you know, at, you know, randomly, right? We want to go back to the public ritual of Black parents crying, Black loved ones grieving in public because they have to bury their family members. That's what you want us to go back to? It's like King and Montgomery after the end of the Selma March. People want normality, want us to go back to the want us to get back to normal. And King says, let me tell you what normal was. And then he lays out all the violence of the South in Alabama. Folk want us to go back to what? So part of what we need to understand is that we bought ourselves some time by seeing the back of Donald Trump's head. And we know that Joe Biden could not have won if it wasn't for Atlanta metro area, if it wasn't for Philadelphia, if it wasn't for Milwaukee and Detroit, if it wasn't for the Navajo Nation and Latinos showing up in Nevada, if it wasn't for the culinary workers showing up in Nevada, if it wasn't for Latino, Hispanic, Latinx folks showing up in Arizona, he wouldn't have won. So the idea is that it's not for us to go back to anything. The country is broken. And so we bought ourselves some time. Now it's time to bring the pressure for something else, you know, for something else, for something much more imaginative and bolder.
So we don't go back, we try to go forward. And I think people are trying to figure out, where is that? What does that look like? And you know, I'm thinking of Dave Chappelle on Saturday Night Live the weekend after the election, you know, after jokes aside said, you know, we need to all stand in some humility and try to figure out a way to live our lives and get to something better. And you've got a line in the book where you say, our task is not to save the Trump voter. Our task is to build a world with no place in it or quarter to breathe. How do you do that? How do you bring 72 million people along, but not build a place to breathe? Because they will say, you may not see some aspects of this that you agree with, but there's some things in there that I needed, that I want. Is there a place for me? How do we figure out this place that Dave Chappelle is talking about?
So what is it that they want? That's the question we need to ask ourselves.
For 72 million people, it's hard to say.
Exactly.
It's all souped in there together.
Right. Do they want a society where I don't have equal standing? Where LGBTQ people aren't acknowledged as full-fledged Americans, right? Do they want a living wage? Do they want to be able to send their kids to college without going? Do they want to be able to live even though somebody in their families gets sick, right? This is how we do it. I think we understand that what we're committed to, right, will make a better world. And we act on it. We don't compromise in some fundamental way. Of course, there's compromise around the edges, but you think about what Ronald Reagan did in 1980. When Reagan was elected, when he was running, most people don't remember this, when he was running, people thought he was bat crazy, right? They thought he was gonna cause World War III. George H.W. Bush called his economic philosophy voodoo economics. They were afraid that this inheritor of Barry Goldwater would destroy American politics. When Ronald Reagan won in 1980, he didn't try to figure out how am I gonna get, you know, the Carter folks to come on board? How am I gonna get these Democrats to join with me? No, he had a set of assumptions and he built his world. And we've been living within that Reagan frame since 1980. Hmm. Everybody's been navigating it. And as Anand Giridharadas says, we shifted from the FDR frame to the Reagan frame. And now we gotta get off that field. We gotta get off that field. So how do we do that? We have to understand that our policies will benefit all Americans. When I talk about a living wage, I'm not just talking about Black folk or brown folk. When I talk about folks shouldn't go broke because they're sick, I'm not talking about Black and brown folk only. I'm not talking about just simply folks in cities, right? And who have college educations, right? I want hospitals in rural areas, right? When we talk about a new moral and social contract for the country, that involves everyone. But if your view of the world is such that it requires that you believe that because you're white, you are valued more than anyone else, that view has no quarter to breathe in the world that we imagine. And I'm not going to compromise on that, because you know what, Tam? I know we got to go. But I know what happens when we compromise with that view. Another generation of our babies will have to grow up in this mess. Every time they compromise with that view, we lose our children. Every single time. I refuse to compromise with it again. I refuse to compromise with that again. Sorry to be so melodramatic. But.
No, I think that was a wonderful place to go and a wonderful place to end, and for people to continue to read the book and sit with it and think about Baldwin and think about some of the things that you've written about in there. We appreciate seeing you on the little screen, on the big screen, in the books. We appreciate what you put into the culture. So thank you. And thank you to everybody who joined us tonight.
Y'all take care and stay safe.
All right, you've earned a good rest. Go elsewhere.
Take care. Bye-bye. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.